Welcome, everybody, to History Analyzed. I'm your host, Mark Palmer. This is a podcast which examines historical events and issues. The event we're analyzing today is Prohibition. That crazy 14-year period from January 1920 through December 1933, when the 18th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution made the manufacture, sale, or transportation of alcohol illegal in the United States. Why did this happen? And more importantly, how did this ever happen? How did the people known as Drys, meaning that they were in favor of prohibition, defeat the Americans known as Wets, the people who wanted to keep alcohol legal? It's a wacky story of a minority of people who might have had good intentions, but discovered the capriciousness of unintended consequences. Before we get into the how and why, let's first explore the legal framework of prohibition. Prohibition came about as an amendment to the U.S. Constitution. The Constitution was written in the summer of 1787 and was adopted in 1788. It's the fundamental law of the U.S. federal government. The Constitution is the supreme law of the United States. The original Constitution had seven articles, which created Congress, the presidency, the Supreme Court, and the powers and duties of the federal government. The Constitution may be amended, but it's not easy. That's why, in the 235 years since the Constitution was ratified, there has been only a total of 27 amendments. Article 5 of the Constitution provides the two processes to amend the Constitution. One way is by a constitutional convention called by two-thirds of the state legislatures. That has never been done. All of the 27 amendments to the Constitution have been passed by the other procedure listed in Article 5. An amendment may be proposed by Congress by two-thirds majority vote in both the House of Representatives and the Senate. Once the Congress approves the proposed amendment, it is submitted to the states for ratification. Three-fourths of the states must ratify the proposed amendment for it to become part of the U.S. Constitution. The 18th Amendment was ratified on January 16, 1919. That means that the 18th Amendment was approved by three-fourths of the states and became part of the Constitution. I'll get into the history of how the 18th Amendment came about later on. But first, we have to ask, why did the temperance forces seek a constitutional amendment? Why didn't they just get a federal law passed through Congress? As I just outlined, it's hard to amend the Constitution. So why'd they do it? Number one, there was a feeling that it would be permanent. A law passed by Congress can be repealed or amended at any point by a later Congress. But constitutional amendments are few and far between. More importantly, up until 1933, no constitutional amendment had ever been repealed. To this day, the only constitutional amendment that has ever been repealed was the 18th Amendment prohibiting alcohol, which was repealed by the 21st Amendment. So you could see how the temperance forces thought that this would be a permanent solution. The number two reason that the anti-alcohol people pushed for a constitutional amendment was because they probably thought that a regular law passed by Congress might be ruled as unconstitutional by the U.S. Supreme Court. Here's a thumbnail sketch regarding constitutionality of particular laws. It's called judicial review. The doctrine of judicial review was established by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1803 in the case of Marbury versus Madison. Most people don't realize this, but the principle of judicial review is not listed anywhere in the U.S. Constitution. It's a power that was established by Chief Justice John Marshall in the Marbury versus Madison decision. Getting back to the question at hand, why would the temperance people worry that a federal law prohibiting alcohol in the U.S. might be ruled unconstitutional? Here's a brief summary. When the Constitution was written, it contained a set of enumerated powers for the federal government. Congress could only pass laws that derived directly from one of those specifically listed powers. Without going through a lengthy constitutional analysis, it was generally considered before World War I that the regulation of the sale of intoxicating liquors was part of the police power reserved to the states and not the federal government. Simply put, the temperance forces thought that there was a fairly good chance that any federal law regulating the production, transportation, or sale of alcohol would be ruled as unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. Therefore, an amendment to the Supreme Court seemed necessary. I'll get into the 18th Amendment and the Volstead Act, which was the federal law to provide for the enforcement of prohibition, in a little bit. But first, let's look at how this came about. Why did the U.S. enact the prohibition of alcohol from 1920 to 1933? It took about a century for prohibition to come into effect. The American Temperance Society was formed in the early 1800s. By the time of the Civil War, the American Temperance Society had lost its appeal. In the late 1800s, the Women's Christian Temperance Union was formed. For women, the push to ban alcohol throughout the U.S. was not a moral crusade like most people think of it today. Most of the prohibition movement was made up of women because of the drastic effects it had on their home lives. The women's movement was trying to avoid the physical, emotional, and economic abuse of women by drunk husbands and men in general. This was a time when women had very few rights. Married women essentially had no rights at all. If they were married, a husband had complete control over everything. In the 1800s, there were not bars like we think of today where people go out, have a few drinks, maybe dance, whatever. The saloons of the 1800s were male-only establishments where a significant portion of husbands would go and spend all of their paychecks before going home. Besides the financial ramifications, married women also had to deal with drunken husbands who could physically beat their wives and children and suffer no legal consequences. This resulted in physical abuse and poverty due to the excesses of men in the saloons. These were some of the many reasons why so many women's groups supported prohibition and why so many individual women joined organizations like the Women's Christian Temperance Union. In the 1800s, some individual states banned alcohol. An example was Kansas. In 1880, Kansas amended its state constitution to prohibit the manufacture and sale of intoxicating liquors within the state. But Kansas would demonstrate that outlawing alcohol is one thing, but enforcing those laws of prohibition is quite another matter. This brings us to one of the most colorful people in the history of the temperance movement, Carrie Nation. She lived from 1846 until 1911. Her first husband was an alcoholic, which caused his death at a young age. This turned Carrie into a fanatic against alcohol. Her second husband was named David Nation, and the two of them moved to Kansas around 1889. After moving to Kansas, Carrie Nation founded a local branch of the Women's Christian Temperance Union. At first, she was simply organizing protests. Later, she claimed she got a calling from God telling her to destroy saloons, and that's what she did. She would go to saloons and throw rocks inside of them and tried to cause as much destruction as she could. But wait, it gets better. She decided that a hatchet was more efficient than rocks. That's right, she started carrying a hatchet into saloons to destroy the bottles of liquor and barrels of beer, along with the bars, tables, mirrors, anything she could. She called these raids hatchetations. She would be accompanied by other women. The men would try to block her from entering saloons, but they did not want to get physically rough with her. These guys did not want to be seen manhandling a woman in her 50s. She got arrested over 30 times. She was usually fined and would simply pay the fine and continue her work. She became infamous in Kansas, Oklahoma, and Texas, where she did her destructive protests. As her fame grew, saloons in that part of the country commonly had signs above the bar that read, "All nations are welcome, except Carrie." Unfortunately for her, Carrie Nation never got to see nationwide prohibition. She died in 1911, about 8.5 years before the 18th Amendment went to effect. As the temperance movement grew throughout the late 1800s and early 1900s, the beer brewers and liquor distillers held a general belief that national prohibition would never occur because the federal government needed the excise taxes on alcohol. An excise tax is a tax on specific goods or services at the time they are purchased. In the early 1900s, somewhere between 20 and 40% of all of the income for the U.S. federal government was from liquor excise taxes. That is a crazy amount. This is why the manufacturers of alcohol figured that the federal government could never outlaw beer and liquor because the federal government would be broke. But things changed with the passage of the 16th Amendment. That amendment to the Constitution reads in total as follows. The Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived without apportionment among the several states and without regard to any census or enumeration. So what was this all about? Why did Congress and the states pass the 16th Amendment? It was in response to a U.S. Supreme Court case in 1895 called Pollock versus Farmers Loan and Trust Company. In that case, the Supreme Court struck down a federal income tax law. The Supreme Court said that the Income Tax Act of 1894 was unconstitutional because it violated Article 1, Section 9 of the U.S. Constitution. I try not to get too involved in the legal issues in these episodes, but sometimes I can't help it. Although my undergrad degree was in history, and it's definitely my academic love, I did practice law for 31 years and find some of these legal matters fascinating. But to keep this fairly straightforward, Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution states in pertinent part, no capitation or other direct tax shall be laid unless in proportion to the census of enumeration herein before directed to be taken. The Supreme Court said that the income tax law from 1894 was a direct taxation scheme not apportioned properly among the states and was therefore unconstitutional. So, the next time you are filing your federal tax returns, consider this. If not for the passage of the 16th Amendment, the federal government would not have the power to make you pay income taxes. Of course, the federal government wanted to collect income taxes. Income taxes supply the federal government with the largest source of income for the U.S. According to taxfoundation.org, in 2021, individual income taxes supplied the federal government with 42.1% of all tax revenue for the U.S. Getting back to how this relates to Prohibition, the 16th Amendment was ratified and became part of the U.S. Constitution in February 1913. This meant that the federal government was not so reliant on excise taxes from alcohol. Beer and liquor and wine were no longer indispensable to fund the American government. The biggest hurdle preventing the temperance movement from achieving its goal had been removed. Now that it was possible, let's look at how the temperance movement prevailed. How were they able to get the 18th Amendment passed? And I know some of you out there noticed that I just referenced the 16th Amendment, which legalized federal income taxes, and I'm now talking about the 18th Amendment, which is prohibition, and you're wondering, what was the 17th Amendment? All right, just so you don't have to look it up, I'll tell you. The 17th Amendment was also ratified in 1913, just 2 months after the 16th Amendment. The 17th Amendment allowed voters in each of the states to select their own senators. I can hear some of you wondering, who selected the senators before? Before 1913, state legislatures chose the U.S. senators for that particular state. Americans always directly voted for members of the House of Representatives. Now they could vote directly for their senators. And at the risk of getting too sidetracked, I have to bring up 1858. And if you've ever read anything about our greatest president, Abraham Lincoln, you've read about his great series of seven debates against Stephen Douglas as they both ran for senator from Illinois in 1858. But they weren't really running for senator. Douglas was campaigning on behalf of the Democrats in Illinois, and Lincoln was campaigning on behalf of the Republicans. Whichever party gained control of the state legislature would select that particular Senate seat representing Illinois. So what you have read in books and probably learned in school is not really true. Lincoln and Douglas were not directly running against each other for the Senate seat. But it was understood by everybody in Illinois that if the Democrats won, Douglas would retain his position as senator, and if the Republicans gained control of the Illinois legislature, then Lincoln would replace Douglas as senator. Spoiler, the Democrats won, and Stephen Douglas retained his seat. But fortunately for America, and the entire world. 2 years later, in 1860, Lincoln beat Douglas and two other candidates to be elected president, and then went on to save the United States and end slavery. Let's get back to Prohibition. We don't have accurate nationwide polling data from those days, but it appears that the temperance movement may have been popular, but was probably never a majority. So how did the 18th Amendment get passed? It was mostly because of the most effective lobbying group ever. I'm not talking about the Women's Christian Temperance Union that I described earlier. I'm talking about the Anti-Saloon League. That group was founded in 1893 in Ohio. It soon grew to a nationwide organization. The Anti-Saloon League published its own newspaper and soon attracted prominent Americans, most notably John D. Rockefeller, the man who founded Standard Oil. There were many reasons why the Anti-Saloon League was so successful. Number one, they focused on only one issue, the prohibition of alcohol. They made sure that candidates understood that the Anti-Saloon League didn't care about any other issues. If a candidate said that he pledged to vote for prohibition, the Anti-Saloon League didn't care if he murdered babies on his spare time. All right, maybe I'm exaggerating a little bit, but not by much. The Anti-Saloon League only looked at that one issue and made it clear that they would vote for or against any candidate based upon the candidate's position on prohibition. The number two reason that they were so successful, the Anti-Saloon League supported both Democrats and Republicans. Since they did not care about any other issues, they didn't care if a candidate was a Democrat or Republican. The number three reason the Anti-Saloon League was so effective was because they could devote tremendous energy for or against particular candidates in close elections. They understood that they would not have much influence on a candidate who was easily going to win an upcoming election. So they looked for close races throughout the country and spoke to both sides, the Democrats and Republicans. They basically said, whoever says they're anti-alcohol is getting our full support, and the other candidate will feel our full wrath. Throughout American history, when a group has a single-minded devotion to one issue, they can be very effective. Their influence is way out of proportion to the number of people in that lobbying group. Starting around 1913, the Anti-Saloon League took the position that they would strive for a constitutional amendment to achieve national prohibition. The Anti-Saloon League also supported the 16th Amendment to allow for federal income taxes. They did this because they understood that the federal government would need another huge source of income if the government was going to lose all of those excise taxes on alcohol. One of the factors that helped the passage of the 18th Amendment was World War I. On April 6, 1917, the U.S. declared war on the Central Powers. Although there were other countries involved, World War I mainly came down to a fight between the Allies of Britain, France, and Russia on one side against the Central Powers, which were Germany, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and the Ottoman Empire. Germany was the primary enemy. With the U.S. declaration of war, anti-German sentiment rose greatly throughout America. The temperance forces, including the Anti-Saloon League, used this to their advantage. It didn't really apply to the winemakers and the distillers of hard liquor, but it very much applied to the brewers of beer. Most of the big brewing companies were owned and operated by either German immigrants or people of German ancestry. This included Anheuser-Busch, Miller, Schaefer, Pabst, and Schlitz. With all this animosity against Germans and German Americans, who was going to feel sorry for these beer companies if they were put out of business? Now let's look into the actual aspects of the 18th Amendment. As the case with most amendments, it's fairly short. It reads in total as follows. After 1 year from the ratification of this article, the manufacture, sale, or transportation of intoxicating liquors within, the importation thereof into, or the exportation thereof from the United States and all territories subject to the jurisdiction thereof for beverage purposes is hereby prohibited. The Congress and the several states shall have concurrent power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. This article shall be inoperative unless it shall have been ratified as an amendment to the Constitution by the legislatures of the several states as provided in the Constitution within 7 years from the date of the submission hereof to the states by the Congress. Several things to unpack there. Number one, This was a compromise between the wets and dries in Congress. The third section of the 18th Amendment states that there was a time limit of only 7 years for it to be ratified or it would be inoperative. That was the first proposed amendment to the Constitution that had a deadline for ratification. There's a famous example of what happens when a proposed amendment is passed by Congress and is then sent to the states without a time limit for approval. The 27th Amendment was the most recent amendment to the U.S. Constitution. It was ratified on May 7, 1992. However, according to the U.S. National Archives, that amendment was originally approved by Congress in 1789. That's right, it took almost 203 years to be ratified by the states. How did this happen? After the Constitution was approved by the required 9 states, it went into effect. However, during the ratification process, many people throughout the new U.S. demanded a Bill of Rights. On June 8, 1789, James Madison introduced a proposed Bill of Rights. After much consideration in both the House of Representatives and the Senate, Congress approved 12 proposed amendments and sent them to the states for ratification. By December 1791, the states ratified the 3rd through the 12th proposals, and they became the 1st through 10th amendments to the Constitution, commonly known as the Bill of Rights. That's where you find many of the rights Americans take for granted, such as freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of the press, protections against unreasonable search and seizure, and a host of other rights. As I told you, only the 3rd through the 12th proposals were ratified. What happened to the other two? The first proposal sent by Congress to the states for ratification has never been ratified. And since I know you're dying to know what it was, it would have changed the number of representatives each state could have in the House of Representatives, allowing for one representative for every 50,000 people. Good thing this was never ratified because it would have been unworkable. If it had been adopted, we would have several thousand members in the House of Representatives today. But what about the second one of the original 12 proposed amendments? As you've probably guessed by now, that's the one that was passed in 1992. Here's what happened. 6 of the 14 states existing at the time ratified the proposed amendment. As I explained earlier, Article 5 of the Constitution requires 3/4 of the states to ratify an amendment. But since there was no deadline on this proposed amendment, it just kind of hung around in limbo. According to the U.S. National Archives, a student at the University of Texas at Austin named Gregory Watson wrote a paper in 1982 about this proposed amendment and started a personal lobbying campaign to have it ratified. By 1982, 3 other states had approved the proposed amendment. That was a total of 9. Since there were 50 states by 1982, the magic number for ratification would be 38. That would be 3/4. On May 7, 1992, Michigan became the 38th state to ratify the proposed amendment, and it became part of the U.S. Constitution and is now known as the 27th Amendment. And you're dying to know, what does that amendment say? Here's the total language. No law varying the compensation for the services of the senators and representatives shall take effect until an election of representatives shall have intervened. Okay, I know I got very sidetracked, but I find the story of the 27th Amendment fascinating. Let's get back to the 18th Amendment and Prohibition. As I mentioned earlier, Section 3 set a deadline of 7 years for passage. Congress passed the 18th Amendment in December 1917 and sent it to the states. The people in favor of Prohibition did not need the 7 years for ratification. It took only 13 months for the proposed 18th Amendment to be ratified. On January 16, 1919, Nebraska became the 36th state to ratify the 18th Amendment. Some of you might have noticed that I said the 36th state, but a little while ago I told you that 38 states were required to pass the most recent, the 27th Amendment. The reason for the difference? In 1919, there were only 48 states. Alaska and Hawaii both joined the Union in 1959. With 48 states, you only needed 36 to pass an amendment, and with 50 states, you need 38. Okay, the 18th Amendment was now the law of the land. What exactly did that mean? Section 1 of the 18th Amendment stated that it would go into effect 1 year from the date it was ratified. This meant Prohibition would take effect on January 16, 1920. Section 2 of the 18th Amendment states that Congress and the states shall have concurrent power to enforce it. Many amendments to the Constitution state that Congress shall have the power to enforce that particular amendment through appropriate legislation. Why do they do that? It's because the amendments, and almost all of the language in the U.S. Constitution, are broadly stated. The primary language of the 18th Amendment is contained in Section 1, where it outlaws the manufacture, sale, or transportation of intoxicating liquors. What does that mean? What exactly is an intoxicating liquor? This is where the Volstead Act came in. On October 28, 1919, Congress passed the Volstead Act. And I mean just Congress. President Woodrow Wilson vetoed the Volstead Act, but then both the House and the Senate overrode the veto. As provided in Article 1, Section 7, Clause 2 of the U.S. Constitution, when a president vetoes a proposed law from Congress, the Congress can override that veto and pass that act by a two-thirds vote in both the House of Representatives and the Senate. The real name of the law was the National Prohibition Act, but it was commonly known as the Volstead Act because it had been sponsored by the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, Minnesota Representative Andrew Volstead. The Volstead Act contained many provisions, but the primary one was the definition of what was an intoxicating liquor. The Volstead Act defined an intoxicating beverage as anything that contained more than one half of 1% alcohol. To put this into perspective, according to the U.S. National Institute of Health, a typical beer in the United States today contains 5% alcohol. Some light beers are 4.2% alcohol content. Wine is typically 12% alcohol. And distilled spirits, meaning hard liquor like whiskey, gin, rum, contain approximately 40% alcohol. So the definition of one half of 1% alcohol made it an intoxicating liquor was an incredibly low bar. The Volstead Act took effect on January 16, 1920. The United States was now officially dry, and all Americans immediately stopped drinking alcohol, right? Obviously, that's not true. Huge segments of the population wanted to continue to drink alcohol. There were many exceptions in the Volstead Act, which allowed the legal consumption of alcohol, and I'll get to those in a little bit. But first, let's deal with illegal liquor. Illegal bars were known as speakeasies. Purportedly, that name came from people being told to speak easy about the secret bars in public. They were run by bootleggers. A bootlegger is any person who makes, distributes, or sells illegal alcohol. Supposedly, the term arose from people concealing flasks of illegal liquor on their legs. Although there were countless numbers of small-time bootleggers, in the big cities, speakeasies were run by organized crime. One of the major unintended consequences of prohibition was the establishment of the mafia in the United States. Prohibition practically created organized crime in the U.S. Before 1920, there were certainly gangs committing crimes in large U.S. cities, but it was on a very small scale, mainly dealing with prostitution, extortion, and gambling. The Sicilian Mafia existed in New York City before Prohibition, but it was minuscule compared to what it became after 1920. Those criminal gangs prior to Prohibition were not coordinated criminal enterprises. In short, they were not what we think of as organized crime. That term, organized crime, would not enter the American lexicon until Prohibition began. The amount of money that could be generated from bootlegging was enormous for smart criminals who knew how to operate like a business. As the 1920s progressed, organized crime syndicates imported alcohol from Canada, Europe, or the Caribbean, or simply ran the illegal distilleries and breweries that were making liquor and beer. Of course, these mobsters were also operating the speakeasies, and these organized crime outfits knew how to keep operating by paying off the federal prohibition agents, the local police, and the local politicians. Let's look at two of the most famous bootleggers. We'll start in New York. When Prohibition began, Charles Lucky Luciano was in his early 20s. He was an immigrant from Sicily and got his start in bootlegging working for Arnold Rothstein. Some of you might recognize that name. Arnold Rothstein is the man who fixed the 1919 World Series, the the Black Sox scandal. Getting back to Lucky Luciano, he is considered the father of modern organized crime in America. The short version of the story is this. In the early 1920s, there was a position in the New York City Mafia known as the Boss of Bosses. In Italian, it's actually Il Capo di Tutti Capi. That literally translates to head of all heads. When Lucky Luciano had the Boss of All Bosses killed, everybody assumed that Luciano would assume that position. But Luciano was smart. He knew that the top guy was always going to be a target, and eventually somebody would want to kill him. So Luciano eliminated the title of Capo di Tutti Capi, and instead organized the commission. What was that? The commission was like a board of directors made up of the heads of the five organized crime families from New York City, as well as the mafia chiefs from Chicago and the other big cities. They divided up territories in the U.S. for each of the crime families. Nobody could encroach on another crime family's territory without approval by the commission. You could not murder somebody that was high up in one of these families without the approval of the commission. If you didn't abide by the commission's rules, then you were murdered. The commission would settle disputes between families and individuals. The idea was to try to keep the peace, since blood was a big expense and attracted the attention of local and federal authorities. The money just poured in. By the mid-1920s, Luciano was the top bootlegger in New York and a multimillionaire thanks to Prohibition. What happened to Lucky Luciano? Well, with the repeal of Prohibition, the major source of income for Luciano, as well as the rest of organized crime, dried up overnight. In 1936, Lucky Luciano was convicted of pandering, meaning operating a prostitution ring. He was sentenced to 30 to 50 years in prison. He was first incarcerated at Sing Sing Correctional Facility. It's located in the town of Ossining, New York, just up the Hudson River from New York City. You've probably heard that term for being convicted, that a person was sent up the river. That's where this term comes from. If you got convicted in New York City, you were sent up the river, meaning the Hudson, to Sing Sing Prison. Luciano only served less than 10 years of his prison sentence. His big break was World War II. Even in prison, Luciano had great influence with the mafia. Luciano made a deal with the U.S. government. There would be no strikes or any other problems on the docks in New York City. The waterfront was completely controlled by the mafia. Further, before Operation Husky, the Allied invasion of Sicily on July 10, 1943, Luciano had arranged for the mafia in Sicily to cooperate with the invading American and British forces. By the way, my father was one of those American soldiers that invaded Sicily in 1943. In fact, right now I'm wearing one of his World War II dog tags. I wear it 24/7. In exchange for Luciano's cooperation, after the war, Luciano was released from prison on the condition that he would be immediately deported back to Italy. Now let's talk about the most famous bootlegger of them all, Al Capone. Capone was born in Brooklyn in 1899. As a young man, Capone supposedly insulted a woman and her brother slashed Al on the cheek with his knife. That's how he got his nickname Scarface, although nobody with any sense would call him that. When he was around 20 years old, Capone moved to Chicago. He quickly moved up the Italian Mafia of Chicago, which was called The Outfit. In 1925, Capone's boss, Johnny Torrio, barely survived a murder attempt. Torrio decided to retire, and Al Capone took over the Chicago Outfit, even though he was only 26 years old. Unlike his mafia counterparts in New York who tried to stay out of the public eye, Al Capone loved the limelight. He became famous not only in Chicago, but throughout the U.S. At his peak, Al Capone was supposedly making approximately $100 million per year from bootlegging. This was in the 1920s. This would be worth approximately $1.7 billion in today's money. That's right, $1.7 billion with a B. And that was per year. Supposedly, Capone was paying approximately $500,000 per month in bribes to police and government officials to allow him to operate his alcohol business. That's approximately $6 million per year in bribes. That's equal to approximately $106 million per year in today's money. The bribes went to everybody from high government officials to the leaders of the Chicago police, down to the cops walking the beat. The amount that people were paid depended upon how high up they were in law enforcement. And of course, they also paid the federal prohibition agents. This widespread corruption in Chicago and most big cities was one of the many unintended consequences of Prohibition. Large segments of the police and others in law enforcement viewed the 18th Amendment and the Volstead Act as ridiculous. They viewed Prohibition as a ludicrous attempt to prevent what appeared to be a majority of the people from doing what they wanted to do, drink alcohol. And it seemed like cops also viewed it as a waste of their time and resources. There were serious crimes like murder and assault and kidnapping that required their attention, and they did not want to spend their time trying to prevent people from drinking. You had those attitudes, along with the generous bribe money paid by major bootleggers like Al Capone, and you can easily see how organized crime grew exponentially throughout the 1920s. Eventually, Al Capone's love of notoriety, along with his ruthless methods, caught up with him. Al Capone's criminal enterprise, the Outfit, ran the south side of Chicago, but the north side of Chicago was run by the North Side Gang, headed by Bugs Moran. Although both the North Side Gang and the Outfit were involved in other criminal activities, the primary source of income for both of them was bootlegging and the operation of speakeasies. In an attempt to finally gain control of all of Chicago, Capone ordered the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. On February 14, 1929, seven members of the North Side Gang were lined up against a wall in a garage in Chicago and shot by four men, two of whom were dressed as police officers. The four hitmen have never been identified. Al Capone was never charged with the crime, even though it is generally believed that he gave the order for the mass murder. In fact, on the day of the shooting, Capone wasn't even in Chicago. He was at his home in Florida. Although there had been gang warfare and murder in the streets of Chicago throughout the 1920s, the St. Valentine's Day Massacre crossed the line as far as the public was concerned. Chicago civic leaders asked the new president, Herbert Hoover, to have the federal government get Al Capone. Although federal authorities tried to nail Capone for bootlegging, murder, or a lot of other criminal activities that he was doing, they could not construct a viable case against him, except for tax evasion. Income taxes had not been around that long. As I explained earlier, federal income taxes were not permitted until the passage of the 16th Amendment in 1913. In 1927, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in the case of United States v. Sullivan that gains from illicit traffic in liquor are subject to the income tax. The court also ruled that the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution does not protect the recipient of that income from prosecution for willful refusal to claim that income in a federal tax return. The Fifth Amendment is the protection against self-incrimination. You see it on TV and in movies when a person pleads the Fifth. Well, in the U.S. versus Sullivan case, the Supreme Court ruled that those protections do not allow a criminal to avoid filing a tax return or avoid claiming illegal income on a tax return. Simply stated, if a person receives income through illegal activity, they still must report it on their income tax return and must pay taxes to the federal government. In the case of Al Capone, the prosecutors did not need to prove where the money came from. They simply had to show that Capone had this income and did not pay taxes on it. Capone's lavish lifestyle and free spending demonstrated how much money he had, and he was not paying taxes on that money. In October 1931, Capone was convicted of tax evasion and sentenced to 11 years in federal prison. At first, he went to the federal penitentiary in Atlanta, but was later transferred to the recently opened Alcatraz Federal Penitentiary on Alcatraz Island in San Francisco Bay. While in prison, Capone was diagnosed with syphilis and gonorrhea. Those sexually transmitted diseases destroyed his mental capacity. He was eventually paroled in November 1939. He died of heart failure on January 25, 1947. He was only 48 years old. Obviously, the repeal of Prohibition did not end organized crime in the U.S. But you have to wonder if organized crime would have grown to the extent it did without that enormous infusion of cash from Prohibition, along with the willingness of the police and government officials to look the other way regarding a crime that they thought was trivial. Prohibition helped integration between blacks and whites in the U.S. slightly. And I'm emphasizing slightly. In big cities, a lot of white people started going to black neighborhoods where they thought they could find more speakeasies. A very weird situation occurred at the famous Cotton Club in Harlem. That was one of the most famous speakeasies in the country in the 1920s. It was extremely popular because it had some of the greatest jazz musicians ever, like Duke Ellington and Count Basie. But what was weird was that the Cotton Club only had black entertainers, but did not allow black patrons. Only white customers were allowed in the Cotton Club. Although Prohibition did not do much for the integration of the races, it did help a lot with the integration of the sexes. Before 1920, drinking establishments were known as saloons and they were male only. Women were not welcome. But the speakeasies accepted women as well as men. All of a sudden, it became common for men and women to drink together in public. The liberation of women was starting. Obviously, it had a long, long way to go. But women could now vote and go to illegal bars and party with men. And this was the decade of the flapper. Flappers were young women who were experimenting with provocative styles like short skirts. By the way, short skirts in those days meant knee length. Flappers bobbed their hair. They smoked cigarettes in public. They listened and danced to jazz music. And they went to speakeasies and private clubs where they could drink illegally. Young women were not just sitting at home waiting for men to come calling. The young women of that generation were going out and creating their own fun. This was a big break with traditional American family values. That was part of the appeal of the speakeasies. Young women from respectable families were now breaking the rules. And there was also somewhat of a sexual revolution. Before World War I, primarily only wealthy people owned automobiles. But in the 1920s, there were millions of cars in the U.S. This meant for the first time in history, young people could easily go off by themselves away from their parents. What about Canada? I think overall, Americans view Canada as a lot more sensible than the U.S. Certainly, they wouldn't impose something as unworkable as prohibition, or would they? Canada never had nationwide prohibition like the U.S. had from 1920 to 1933, but the individual provinces could institute their own prohibition laws. And for those of you listening to this that are not familiar with the structure of Canada, there are 10 provinces that are kind of like the states are in the U.S. There are also three enormous territories. At the time of the temperance movement in Canada, there were only 9 provinces. Amazingly, Newfoundland was independent and did not join Canada until 1949. Independent Newfoundland and the 9 Canadian provinces all had some form of alcohol prohibition for different periods of time in the early part of the 20th century. Although prohibition in Quebec only lasted less than a year in 1919. I'm now going to tell you the least understood aspect of prohibition. Fun fact, it was not illegal to drink alcohol during prohibition. Let me say that again. The consumption of alcohol was not illegal between 1920 and 1933 in the U.S. Drinking alcohol wasn't made illegal by the 18th Amendment. The only thing made illegal was the manufacture, sale, or transportation of alcohol within the U.S. Since the 18th Amendment did not take effect for 1 year after it was ratified on January 16, 1919, people had 1 year to accumulate as much alcohol as they could and to stash it in their homes. This didn't help the average person much, but a lot of wealthy people acquired giant wine cellars and large inventories of liquor. The Volstead Act allowed for 2 big exceptions for the sale of alcohol. The first one was for medical reasons. Drugstores were allowed to sell liquor to people who had a prescription from a doctor that they needed the whiskey or whatever liquor for some medical condition. How crazy was that? You sometimes see in the old movies people taking a sip of alcohol and saying, "For medicinal purposes." There were limits as to how much alcohol a person could get in a given month, even with a prescription. But this led to a lot of payoffs to doctors for these liquor prescriptions. A second big exception under the Volstead Act was the sale of wine for religious purposes. Sacramental wine for Catholic masses helped save California's vineyards during Prohibition. Nationally, the enforcement of Prohibition was a joke. It's tough to enforce a law that is preventing large segments of the population, probably a majority, from doing something that they really want to do. The federal government hired Prohibition agents to crack down on bootlegging, the speakeasies, and the importation of alcohol from outside the U.S. But there were not nearly enough of these Prohibition agents. Also, they weren't paid much. This meant that they were very easy to bribe. Once people understood how much bribe money there was available, more and more people wanted to become Prohibition agents. The actual pay may have been very little, but the amount of graft available was fantastic. The federal government never set aside enough money to truly enforce Prohibition. Section 2 of the 18th Amendment states that the Congress and the states shall have concurrent power to enforce Prohibition. People in Congress thought, naively, that the states would carry a lot of the burden of enforcing Prohibition. It didn't turn out that way. Most state governments did not want to spend their limited resources on enforcing Prohibition. One of the most shameful aspects of Prohibition was how the federal government was responsible for poisoning a lot of Americans. Many people were made permanently blind or even died from liquor made in illegal stills. By the mid-1920s, federal government officials had learned that the bootleggers were using industrial alcohol to make their illegal liquor. Industrial alcohol is not intended for human consumption. In 1906, the U.S. government required certain chemicals be mixed into industrial alcohol to make it undrinkable. Due to the incredible amounts of money available, bootleggers were paying chemists to remove those chemicals from industrial alcohol to make it potable. To stop bootleggers and their chemists from turning industrial alcohol into drinkable alcohol, the federal government in the mid to late 1920s started requiring the addition of more poisonous chemicals to industrial alcohol. The idea was that people would hear about how dangerous the illegal alcohol was and they would stop buying it from illegal sources. Of course, we know that doesn't work. Today, people die every day from consuming illegal narcotics, even though the general public knows that there are a lot of dangerous chemicals mixed into the narcotics sold by drug dealers. It was the same in Prohibition, and it had a much larger effect on the poor and working class Americans. Wealthy people were buying imported alcohol that was safe. The poorer classes were consuming much riskier alcohol. And I'm not talking about trivial figures. There are estimates that more than 10,000 people died nationwide from drinking poisonous alcohol. Did Prohibition decrease the amount that Americans drank? The National Bureau of Economic Research, a nonprofit research organization in Cambridge, Massachusetts, did a study in 1991 regarding the amount Americans drank during the Prohibition years. That study determined that at the beginning of Prohibition, Americans consumed only about 30% of the amount of alcohols they did prior to Prohibition. However, by the late 1920s, Americans drank more and were consuming alcohol at about 60 to 70% of the amounts they did before the 18th Amendment. By the 1930s, most Americans were fed up with Prohibition. The novelty and the excitement of the speakeasies had worn off. People were tired of paying more money for illegal alcohol, which was often of poor quality and many times dangerous to their health. And there was a growing resentment of the corruption of government and law enforcement due to Prohibition. And lastly, people were fed up with the violence from organized crime related to bootlegging. In addition to those sentiments, economics came into play. One of the main reasons why Prohibition ended was the Great Depression. Starting with the Wall Street crash of October 1929, the U.S. and most of the industrial world sank into the greatest economic depression in history. The legalization of alcohol could create a lot of jobs. When Prohibition took effect, it did not just cost the jobs of people who worked in breweries, distilleries, and wineries. There were many ancillary jobs, like people who manufactured bottles, casks, and labels, that were also lost. In addition to helping the financial situation of countless individuals, a lot of people were arguing that the federal government could benefit from all of the tax revenue if alcohol was legal again. In 1932, Franklin Roosevelt ran for president and called for the repeal of Prohibition. FDR won in a landslide. Not because of that, but it certainly didn't hurt. So how did national prohibition end? Since prohibition was sanctioned by the 18th Amendment, the only way to repeal prohibition was another amendment to the Constitution, and that was the 21st Amendment. As I told you earlier, the 18th was the only amendment that was repealed by another constitutional amendment. Although it's normally a difficult process to amend the American Constitution, the 21st sailed through easily. The 21st Amendment was proposed by Congress in February 1933. Then it was sent to the states for ratification. That's usually a long process, but the 21st Amendment was ratified by December 5, 1933. That was only 10 months. That is incredibly fast. Fun fact, the 21st is the only amendment to be ratified by state ratifying conventions. Usually, the state legislatures vote whether or not to ratify a proposed constitutional amendment. But Article 5 of the Constitution states that Congress may require state ratifying conventions to approve a proposed amendment instead of ratifications by 3/4 of the state legislatures. Congress has only done this once, and that was the 21st Amendment, where it specifically stated that it would only become part of the Constitution if it was ratified by state conventions. Here's the entire language of the 21st Amendment. The 18th Article of Amendment to the Constitution of the United States is hereby repealed. The transportation or importation into any state, territory, or possession of the United States for delivery or use therein of intoxicating liquors in violation of the laws thereof is hereby prohibited. This article shall be inoperative unless it shall have been ratified as an amendment to the Constitution by conventions in the several states, as provided in the Constitution, within 7 years from the date of submission hereof to the states by the Congress. So, do we have prohibition in the United States today? Yes, we do, just not on a national level. States can have prohibition laws. However, there are no completely dry states. This means that there are no states where alcohol is prohibited statewide. However, there are plenty of counties or towns that are dry, meaning you can't buy alcohol. It's more widespread than you think. A majority of states allow counties or towns to prohibit the sale of alcohol. But in some of those states, there are no dry counties or towns because none of the counties or towns have enacted prohibition laws. There is one dry locale in the U.S. that I find hilarious. That is the town of Panaca, Nevada. When we think of Nevada, we think of a state where anything goes. This is the home of Sin City, Las Vegas. Prostitution is legal in 10 different counties in Nevada, although not Clark County, where Las Vegas is located. There are plenty of prostitutes in Clark County, but it's not legal. So how does Nevada have a town that is dry? Panaca is an unincorporated town in Lincoln County, Nevada, with a population of around 1,000. The town was founded as a Mormon colony in 1864 and has remained dry to this date. That's it for today. Please subscribe to this podcast. Please like this and my other episodes. Ratings and likes greatly help with the placement of podcasts on apps. So if you're listening on a podcast app like Spotify or Apple, which allow for ratings, I would greatly appreciate a 5-star rating. You can easily leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts by scrolling down the History Analyzed show page, selecting a star rating, and tapping Write a Review. Please tell your friends, relatives, coworkers about History Analyzed. That's the best way to increase the audience for this podcast. Please check out my website, historyanalyzed.com. Thank you so much for listening. Catch you next episode.